You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the same clothes look different on different body types. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and I am referring to the strawberry dress controversy, within which Jezebel called the strawberry dress fascist on skinnier women. So if you want to go down that rabbit hole, good luck to you. That's all I'm going to do to address it right now, because, oh my God, is there a lot of farce. There is a lot of farce, and that is why we are all here, is to witness all this farce. So I would rather just get on with it by introducing my co-host, joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, there's a... We had so much to do, so much to cut through, all the craziness that is going on here. But, you know, it's been a great weekend. A couple weeks ago, I installed the automatic opener on my front trunk, the frunk in my Tesla. And this weekend, a friend came over and we actually installed the rear one, which involved taking the bumper out and taking a bunch of the trim out. So it was really cool to sort of get into the car and get some work done, even though it's quite hot here, Justin. It's almost Florida temperatures here right now. So it's been a bit of a sweaty work out in the garage, but it was so much fun to get in there and step away from the wokeness. And just for the record, we were not social distancing while underneath the car taking off a bumper. So if the mayor's going to shut off my water, I might have to come out to you in Florida so that I can drink water.
I just come here. I mean, honestly, just come here. That's the way to go. And I did hear about your heat wave and all the rolling blackouts during the heat wave.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah.
That was one of the stories we unfortunately had to cut because there was so much farce. But just California is falling apart.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
All right. On that note, there is a California story. We'll get into that. That's our second story. But let's head into the news. The news right now in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
I almost said before I threw it out here, the news with Daniel T. Richards, but it's without. So
that's
just
right.
Sorry about that. We always miss Dan here in the midside. And before we get into the news, I just want to really quickly plug Patreon and Locals. If you want to support us per episode, you want to support us per month, we have different options for that. If you don't like Patreon, if you don't like Locals, we've got all sorts of options for you. You can go to themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/Locals. Your support is always appreciated, and it helps us keep the lights on in this closet I am recording in right now. And why am I recording in a closet? Because I'm full of shame, just like the people who work in restaurants in Maine. There's a news article here, Cones of Shame. Maine orders restaurant servers to don face shields like dog collars in bizarre COVID-19 guidelines. To me, William, bizarre COVID-19 guidelines is redundant.
Yeah, well, they're all mostly performative right now, right?
And this is a perfect example of a performative one. I'm going to read a couple quotes here. The latest COVID-19 prevention checklist issued by Democratic Governor Janet Mills lays out a series of rules one might expect amid the pandemic, such as good hygiene and social distancing. Again, I'm going to stop here. Those are good no matter what's going on. Can you imagine? The good hygiene only matters in a pandemic. Keeping socially distant from people you don't know only matters in a pandemic. It's insane. These things we're writing. But one guideline for restaurants has raised eyebrows. Right. Not what I just said didn't raise eyebrows. One guideline. Demanding that servers don collared face shields reminiscent of those fixed to dogs after a medical procedure. Front of house staff may wear a face shield in lieu of a face covering only if the shield is designed to be worn inverted, attaching below the face, e.g. as a collar, and open at the top of the shield, with the shield extending above the eyes and laterally to the ears, the guideline says. How big do these fucking shields have to be nowadays? Like, why don't they just put us in hazmat helmets at this point?
You didn't see picture of the poor, fast food workers standing out in the drive-thru wearing, like, almost like a hazmat tent around them?
Yeah, I saw it. Man, yeah. It looks like Cloverfield, you know, where they have the triage going on because people are going to explode because they've been attacked by the monster, and they have people in those tents and they put them behind the tents and they explode. That's what it all looks like.
Yeah.
But I mean, at this point, William, isn't this showing that we're all just animals to the government?
Well, it is a cone of shame. I mean, it looks just like the dog cone of shame you get post-surgery. I laugh at it, but I'm not sure I could ask my employees to do this, right? Like, even if there's a mandate, like, I wouldn't be able to ask them to do this. It just seems it's too arbitrary and demeaning, right?
Right. That's why I was saying they're treating us all like animals, because they're not taking our humanity into account. I mean, I've thought that about the masks from the beginning, and you raise another interesting point. What it really does is it puts you in the position of having to respect people's humanity or not. And then who does it put at risk? It puts you at risk.
Yeah, only me. Right. Yeah.
Right, only you. And that's...
I mean, that's how it is now with the current mask laws, right? Like,
right.
I do deal with some customers who are upset about, you know, details around the procedures, right? We have really good procedures in place. But, you know, they wish people would... one of the ridiculous ones that's kind of obviously ridiculous is, standing on the line, the staff are not 6 feet apart, right?
And you talked about that before, how there's not enough space in the establishment in order for them to do that and prepare food.
Yeah. So people have inquired about that, to put it nicely, in a Karen voice, and there's nothing I can say, right? Like, there's nothing I can do or say that, and for the staff, like, you know, if the staff just decided not to wear a mask, I could send them home, but like, how many people can I send home, right? Like, at a certain point, there's no one left.
That's okay. Here's the real thing, right? Because you can say the same thing to the person who complained. You can say, well, you have two options or three options. One, you can just let it go and we'll serve you. Two, you can leave and you're welcome to, and we understand if you don't feel safe, but these are the physical limits of our space. Or three, because of the physical limits of our space, you can call the health department and ask to have us shut down because we can't operate safely during this pandemic according to your standards. And I forgot where I was going with that, but
yeah, the problem is three, though. The problem is three, right?
Right. Fuck, I forgot where I was going. Well, yeah, that is the problem, because it's just putting like, it's, oh yeah, I remember where I was going. Sorry. I don't know why my brain just completely farted there, but isn't that the ultimate goal? Isn't three the ultimate goal? Isn't this the ultimate goal? Destruction. That's the purpose of all of this. Is it not?
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, there's things that are happening now, because of the panic, right? People are allowing things to happen that they would have never gotten away with before. Completely unrelated, but certainly the same logic here. So go with me on this short journey. In Australia, they're basically passing a law saying that the establishment media should, one, get 60% more revenue from Google, and two, should be able to see Google, some of the YouTube, like, inner private data, right? Like, how the algorithm works and what things are trending and stuff. In other words, have special access to data for YouTube. This is in Australia. this law has been proposed in the last month, I guess. And people are, a couple people are concerned and trying to raise some noise about it, because the only reason this isn't, you know, front page headlines is because everything else is all coronavirus, right? And so this is very much a time where, you know, they're always testing what can we get away with, but right now they're finding they can get away with a lot.
Yeah, and that's all part of it, because it's all, as I said, it's all anti-life, and you're just pointing out another way it's anti-life. And I think that's the biggest takeaway here. They want people to act like animals. They treat them like animals, and then they create unreasonable standards that no one can actually meet. So you're either suffering in silence, and you're suffering twice, right? You're suffering physically, but you're also suffering psychologically with the knowledge that you can't actually satisfy this criteria, right? Because that creates a culture of fear, where if everyone knows that at any point they could just be, you know, popped for breaking the law, well, then they're going to live in fear and in guilt too, to a certain extent. And then there's, let's just move on to that. Do you have anything to add to this story?
No,
I don't know why. I've had a tough week.
Your brain's in like first gear. We gotta get you into second gear.
I've had a tough week, and I'll talk about it in an upcoming episode here once the entire sort of incident is resolved. But just a lot going on with me right now. But the point is, you know, these people are just fucking with us, and they're treating us like animals, and they're destroying life. And the second way is they're using this to put stuff on behind the curtains. So, speaking of which, holy shit, William, what the fuck happened in California with Uber and Lyft? I have a news article here from Variety. Again, the entertainment fucking rags are more objective. I talked about this last week, are more objective in covering these stories than the actual fucking media in LA. So why Uber and Lyft were on the brink of shutting down in California? The ride-sharing companies have fought back after losing on an earlier ruling. They appealed the decision. On Thursday, a California appeals court granted Uber and Lyft an emergency stay from complying with the law. The law is, of course, that they have to classify their drivers. I don't even want to say their drivers. The drivers who use their app as employees, not as independent contractors. They have claimed they need additional time to rework their business operations in order to be able to hire their current drivers as employees, which I think is true. Fundamentally, their position is that they are tech platforms that facilitate transactions between riders and drivers, and therefore that the companies don't have an employer-employee relationship with those workers. Lawmakers in California and elsewhere have found that unconvincing. So, William, before we get into what has happened since, isn't their stance correct? Isn't that what they're doing? They're providing an infrastructure, but they're not hiring these people?
Yeah, I think what we have here is a new business model. It's not really new, because it's been around how many years now? Jesus. But it's new in the sense of the law has not caught up to it. And what we're seeing here is to put it politely, a disagreement, right, between lawmakers and what the market has created, right? Market has created this new kind of relationship. You know, it's kind of called colloquially the gig economy, right? And California's already fucked this up for authors. I'm not sure exactly all the details, but you can only write like X number of stories before they would have to hire you as an employee. And this puts people who are sort of, you know, serial freelancers at incredible risk if they have to deal with a California-based company, or they live in California. In other words, their company is based in California.
Right, because the company will only hire them for X number of articles and then say, well, we got to hire somebody else now. Sorry, that's the law.
Yep. So what they are having to do is incorporate, which is a whole nother big deal and super expensive in California, as I can go into lots of details. So your alternative is to incorporate and get taxed all to hell or leave California. So, I don't know. A lot of independent journalists have left California. And I think what you'll see next is, I would sort of say, where does this end? I'm going to go back to YouTubers for a second. Isn't YouTube, I mean, YouTube is a, it becomes a little easier to see when you talk about it in terms of YouTubers. YouTubers are freelance video creators. Shouldn't they be hired as employees and paid health insurance by YouTube? According to this logic? I mean, YouTube dictates what they can and cannot upload, right? Via the algorithm, they certainly dictate how frequently they can upload if they want to succeed, right?
Right.
And you can go or come. You can not, you can upload and not upload as frequently as you want, right? It's just like Uber.
The same way that the app can control how many passengers you get, Google, because they own YouTube, can control how many viewers you get.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So I think we should, you know, I like illustrating absurdity by being absurd. I think YouTubers should be hired as full-time employees.
100%, because what this is missing, right? This is missing the idea of freedom coming first. And what I mean by that is, are they stopping to think that there might be, especially in the case of writers, people who prefer to be freelance? Maybe they prefer to just sell per article than to work under a deadline, in the sense that you have an editor assigning you a story you don't necessarily want to do. Maybe they prefer just pitching and then they can just sell whatever specific article they have. This is not, this is one of these things where, again, it goes back to the first story, where this is really anti-life and it's pro-government, because they claim they're looking at the perspective of the employee, of the little guy, of the non-company, but they're actually hurting the people. And why are they hurting them? Because this is their way to get more control and more control over your life and make your life worse. I really believe it.
Yeah.
Is they're trying to make your life worse. I mean,
I want to
their life is worse.
I want to go over an argument though. I heard a friend of mine, I won't say the name, because they're completely honest in this reasoning, but they're completely wrong. They, you know, I sort of gave them the background and said, you know, hey, like, you know, the court has stayed this order for now, but it looks like we have a vote for it coming up, a ballot measure, and of course it only applies to Lyft and Uber, which is not a very good principled stance. And I said something along the lines of, you know, I think this is not wise to only include Lyft and Uber. And they were a little confused, and they said, well, you know, I guess if the majority of Lyft and Uber drivers don't want to be classified as employees, then that would be okay. And so what's wrong with that logic? What's wrong with that logic is it comes back to that collectivism versus individualism thing that we try to focus on here. Even if there are only 10 drivers that want to be classified as contractors versus employees, that should be a voluntary arrangement between Uber and the driver. If they want to be employees, you can actually work at Uber as an employee, right? And they aren't drivers usually. But or at all, I think. But when you remove that voluntary transaction, that's when it becomes quite evil, right? You're saying, you're not only telling the drivers who want to be, who like this current arrangement, who have voluntarily entered this current arrangement, that they can no longer enter this arrangement, but then you're forcing Uber to act against its judgment and enter into an involuntary arrangement, an arrangement they would not have otherwise entered. And that's quite evil, right? And I don't, you know, we've talked about before how Lyft and Uber, Uber specifically sort of, you know, took their ball and went home from Austin, right? If you remember, we covered that story a few years back. And this is another example of kind of getting close, but unless you actually take that principled stance, you're not really going to help yourself in the long run. I don't think Uber's going to help himself in the long run by carving out a special exception, right? They should be advocating for the principle here, right? They should be partnering with the Institute for Justice or one of those advocacy orgs that fight for economic freedom in and actually make a stand here, a principled stand, versus just saying, well, I bet we can lobby the government and get this, carve us out a special exemption, you know, fuck everyone else.
Right, because what you're referring to, William, is the way we approach government, because we don't approach it principally. We approach it as if there's a problem, we have to figure out a way to pragmatically have government solve it. And supposedly there's a problem here. And the problem is also anti-life, and I'll get into that in a second. But the solution to the supposed problem is, oh, we'll have government fix it. It's not saying, okay, what are you identifying as a problem? Okay, what do the principles say about how to deal with that problem? And you've made a very clear line from principles of freedom and the trader principle to voluntary exchange to government has no right to regulate this. But they're seeing a problem, and this is the problem they're actually seeing. A lot of people who are doing Uber and Lyft are not people who are doing it because they choose to. And what I mean by that is, it's not like they're rational, healthy people who are otherwise skilled or they just really enjoy driving. It's they are or they're seen as by the government people who are less able, and this is their only option. So government feels like they need to make sure these people are taken care of. But as we've seen, what this ends up doing is just hurting people of ability who are making those rational choices to drive that, or as you said in the freelance thing as well, it hurts the people who are rationally choosing that. So all of this is anti-life because it's anti-principles. And as you're saying, you see how collectivism very quickly gets to anti-life because it takes individual choice out of the equation. And when we're talking about the insanity of individualism versus collectivism, man, was there a lot of farce this week and a couple good articles about diversity and anti-racism. So the first one, and the second one's going to be couched in this one, is the whole Goodyear diversity training episode. So this article from Forbes is what the Goodyear episode can teach us about diversity training. And I think the best way to start with this, William, is to say that they put in place a policy, and they talked about it during diversity training. And there's actually audio that leaked of it. So, William, do you want to play that audio?
Yeah, we got to give a little context here because there's a little bit of political theater going on, which we talk about the Trump accidentally stumbling into doing a politically right thing, right in the sense of politically savvy thing. So this slide came out that showed a list of things that were allowed, like LGBT, Black Lives Matter, and then a list of things that weren't allowed, MAGA, All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter. Those things are not allowed under this policy. And Goodyear put out a statement saying that that this
come
was...
Come on, man. Like, the audio says that. The guy says what they can and can't wear.
I know, but it's important to understand the timeline here. So Trump tweets that we should boycott Goodyear, and Goodyear points out a statement that, no, this is just a misunderstanding of our statement. Then the next day, this audio leaks. That's why this is important. So here's the audio from a manager.
So before you play it, you're saying what we need to talk about here is the fact that the audio leaked after everything else.
I'm saying that's an important piece of context to understand.
Okay, you're approaching the story differently than I am, because I was approaching it from what the fuck is going on with all this diversity bullshit.
Yeah, so we can both those, I think both, we have to look at both things, but here's the audio.
That with elections coming, I see a lot of people wearing, you know, election type stuff, Democrat, Republican, Trump, Biden, Sanders, whatever, okay? That will no longer be allowed in the plant. No face masks, no shirts, anything political will not be allowed in the plant, okay? I'll read this part so everybody understands it. A lot of you probably already heard this part. But some people may wish to express their views on social justice or inequity or equity issues such as Black Lives Matter or LGBTQ pride on their face covering, shirts, or wristbands, that will be deemed approved because it complies with zero tolerance stance. However, if any associate wears all blue White Lives Matter shirts or face covering, that will be not appropriate. The reason for this is because these slogans are not reflective of a social justice or equity issue. Okay? So there's rules now.
So I love the people who just start laughing in the middle there. I love that people just...
I didn't know we had Midsiders at the Goodyear plant.
they were
literally witnessing the farce, Justin.
100%. And there are more of us out there than people realize. They don't know what the Midside is explicitly. They know it's Sense of Life-wise, but there are more of us out there than you think. And I love that they're there and they're to that point. Because that's the point I am at with a lot of this stuff. But why don't you talk about the timeline and you do your analysis of the timeline.
Yeah. So I think this is one of those instances. I should have pulled up the tweet from Goodyear. Goodyear really tried to say that this was okay, right? Like this was just this wasn't a slide that we here at corporate did. This was just a misunderstanding of our policy that we don't allow politics at work. And then in the very tweet, they say, and then we allow this kind of social justice stuff, right? So in the tweet, they kind of self-owned, but with the weaselly words, you could kind of, squint and say, okay, whatever. But then the next, I think it was within 48 hours, the audio leaked. And so whoever on the sort of like Trump side, which I'm assuming is kind of involved here, with this dribbling out of information did it in like a masterful way, right? Put the slide out, let Goodyear put out this statement saying, oh, it's not that big a deal. It's just a misunderstanding. And then boom, the audio. The other thing I want to mention before we get into your analysis, which I think we're going to find really valuable, is I have to give props to this manager. And what I mean by that is you can tell he is trying to sell something he doesn't believe in, right? He's like, and I'm going to read this policy to you exactly, right? Like, and I know some of you already know it, right? He's trying his best to represent the company when you can tell he doesn't understand this either. He doesn't understand the why of this, right? Like what, like this is what we have to do. So we're going to try and do it, right? And, we'll have a link to the, incredibly shitty local news website that has the full link. If you really want to get a study in how to try to present a policy that, maybe you don't agree with, but in a way that will, help people understand the policy. This is certainly an exercise in that, but man, I feel bad. I feel nothing but empathy for this manager having to, sell this bullshit to his staff.
I mean, I'm not surprised you feel that empathy. It goes back to what we were talking about with the store where you're put in the same position. It's literally the same exact thing.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. And the thing he really, you can tell, is he's like, it's not a social justice or equity issue that they're forcing him to say those words. And I think that's what's really interesting about this whole story. I think you laid out something very interesting in the way things are being done strategically now, that it seems like maybe the other side is starting to organize and fight back a little bit with their PR, which is interesting. But I think the underlying issues are the most important.
Yeah,
so this article from Forbes, I want to read a couple quotes from, because I think they missed the boat here a little bit. There's a better way. Diversity training can and should include attention to viewpoint diversity. In addition to fostering an appreciation and respect for ethnicities, genders, sexual orientation, gender identities, etc., companies should also help their employees appreciate and understand that reasonable people, including their own coworkers, who have a range of different political perspectives on the company, on the complex social issues of the day. People in companies need better tools to communicate with others with whom they might not agree. These tools include having a better understanding of the different ways people understand the world, and the wide variation in motivations that people have for the positions they take. Humility, curiosity, and effective communication can be modeled and they can be learned. I think that this perspective by this author is completely naive, and I think it goes back to what I've been harping on this entire episode, this anti-life mentality. I don't think the point of this social justice equity approach is actually equality. If it was, they wouldn't have to create a new term. And, equity as defined is really, as we've said before, backing into individualism, where it's you take everybody's individual context into account. But no, they package deal equity with collectivism, where they say, oh, well, this individual has this problem. Well, this is a systemic issue, so we need to fix the systemic issue in order to be equitable. I have no problem with being equitable to individuals. If you look at two individuals with different circumstances, William, don't you treat them differently based on their circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, that what you're describing, Justin, is the principle of justice, right?
Correct. Nailed it 100%. So they're taking justice and they're redefining it as equity, because it's justice plus collectivism is what social justice means when they mean equity.
Right. And you destroy the concept of justice when you do that.
Correct. And I don't like to talk about my school a lot, but they talked about equity, and the way they defined it is justice. So I don't have a problem with the way they defined it, where they said a student may have certain circumstances that hurts them from being able to receive teaching in the same way, so you can't teach them the same way. I have no disagreement with that statement. You have to teach every student differently. I have no disagreement with that statement. But the problem is people are using equity differently. And I think what's missed here is when you're using it in the social justice collectivist sense, it's intended to divide us. And the greatest example of that is an article sent to us about a New York City Community Education Council for Manhattan District 2 meeting. And this article was sent to us by Trailer Takedown Dan. And I think the article title is so perfect. It gets the point. Anti-racist arguments are tearing people apart.
You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
That is what I think whenever I think of this stuff. It's so perfect because that's what they're doing to us. So in this meeting, there were accusations of racism and demands that council members educate themselves on anti-racism. And that's the little summary I wrote for it, but it's actually much more insidious, because the first thing you have to think about is context, William. This is a Zoom meeting, right? So these are in people's houses. This isn't like there's a council meeting and they're in the council chambers, or they're, you know, this shitty council probably just meets in like, this council meeting probably looks like an AA meeting, to be honest, I would guess, because they said they're not
folding
even
chairs.
Like officially, they're not even officially recognized or anything. I'm thinking of, do you know the scene in Avengers Endgame after the 5 years after the snap, where Captain America is like leading a counseling group? That's what I'm picturing this meeting would look like if it wasn't on Zoom. Yeah. But this meeting is on Zoom. And what happened was, this old white guy was in his house, and during a break or something, a family friend was there. And she, without asking him, put her child in his lap. Now, everyone's flipping out over this. They're flipping out over this. And I don't, not everyone, but people are flipping out over this because the child and the mother are black. And their essential argument was he was being performative about it. Like, I'm not racist. Look at me taking care of a black baby.
And then he performed a magic trick and made the baby disappear.
By putting the baby off camera. But that's his response. His response is, this is just my family friend who's at the house all the time. And then the black woman actually has a response where she's like, I don't know why you guys are telling me what's racist and what's not when I'm a black woman. Right? Doesn't she say that, I believe?
Yeah, she does.
Right. Which is ridiculous. It's like, Black Lives Matter, but us white women are going to tell the black women. So there's a couple quotes here from this analysis that I want to read and then sort of springboard off of. If a member of a civic body expressed, the other people on the board who found it offensive were calling, saying, you're not educated on anti-racism and you need to read these books about anti-racism, like White Fragility and those books.
Yeah. You must read the sacred texts.
Right. If a member of a civic body expressed frustration that a colleague refused to read the Bible, the Quran, the Wealth of Nations, the Communist Manifesto, Atlas Shrugged, or Dianetics, and couldn't understand an accusation until they did, most observers would see the problem. Drawing on outside concepts is fine, but if you can't explain your position unless everyone reads your source material, then the fault lies with you. No one at a public meeting should have to read the books you consider important, much less accept that the ideas in those books are sacrosanct. I agree with all of that 100%. I can explain individualism and its importance to life without constantly referring to Ayn Rand and objectivism. And actually, that's one of the biggest things I hate is when objectivists do that. Next quote. As long as sharp disagreements persist about what causes racial inequality and how best to remedy it, deliberations rooted in the specific costs and benefits of discrete policies will provide a better foundation for actual progress than meta-arguments about what anti-racism demands. They missed the point here, William.
Yeah.
The point that's missed is these people have created a way. They've backward engineered a philosophy. They see the world a certain way. They see the world through the lens of collectivism, and they've created anti-racism as a way to say that's how you have to see the world. And if you don't see the world how I do, you're not anti-racist. That's all they've done. And
if you're not born again, you should not be able to run for office, right?
Right, but even the born again thing isn't this extremely different of a lens of looking at reality. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think there's a lot. Yeah, there is a subtle difference here, but I think that the essentials are the same, right? Like this is
if you're not
think of like a little more extreme, you know, Southern Baptist, Mormon, Jehovah's Witness. This is that, right? If you're not in the cult, then clearly you don't see reality the way we do. And therefore you just need to be converted. You need to read the text. You need to read the Book of Mormon. You need to read whatever the Jehovah Witness version of the Bible is, right?
I agree with that. However, I think there is a subtle difference in the extremity that makes this even more insidious. Everything you said is correct, but I would think that the Southern Baptists, and if there's any Southern Baptists out there listening to us, though I doubt it, you can correct me.
I'm a recovering one, so I'll speak on their behalf.
All right. My understanding is they would say there would be two consequences for not seeing reality the way they do. One, you can't achieve true personal happiness in your current life. And two, you will not be saved when you die. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much right.
Okay, here's the difference. These anti-racist people, seeing it through the lens of collectivists, are saying you directly become a threat to other people if you do not see the world the same way they do. And that is much more insidious.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, there is an intolerant streak in some of the more fundamentalist religions, right? Like they would say, you are evil, right? And that's sort of the vestiges of the sort of medieval Christianity, right? Where we must cleanse the evil from you, right? To save your soul for your sake. But even then, there's still a little bit of for your sake in there, right? But here, there's no sake for the white people, right? For the oppressors. There's no saving them. There's no redeeming them. They are doomed. They were born racist. They're doomed to be racist forever. And all they can do is atone, but their atonement will never be enough. It's a black hole of atonement.
How dare you, black hole?
A gravitational singularity hole. There we go.
There you go. It's a gravitational singularity of atonement. Come on, William. Use anti-racist language.
That's
exactly the point. That is exactly the point. And this is where the author of this article misses the boat, where the meta argument is extremely important here. Because we are not talking about philosophy. William, even when you just talked about Southern Baptists, I was able to parse that down to some sort of theological perspective.
Yeah.
Right? A theological perspective of this is how it will affect your life. But even then, we didn't really talk about the theology of why it would affect your life in that way. It still at that point becomes, even with the discussion of Southern Baptists, it became a psychological discussion. You won't be able to achieve true happiness. Well, this is a psychological thing. This is about how people psychologically see the world, and they're trying to codify that into a philosophy to force other people to accept their psychology. You're right. It's insidious in the same way religion is, but I see it as even more insidious for the reasons I said. And this meta discussion needs to be had. They needed in that meeting to say, if you are going to sit here and you are going to act like that, then we need to decide what the purpose of this council is. Is this council an anti-racist council, or is this council an education council? And if they see no difference.
Yeah, and the answer
to
that.
Decide.
Yeah, the answer to that is so important, right? You do need to check your premises, right? I see this quote as kind of being a mix of something I would agree with and something I won't agree with. You know, this is something that I think a lot of the social justice sort of devotees want to avoid, right? They want to avoid this thinking, well, thinking in general, but thinking about where they can partner with people they don't agree with. Because guess what? And I know, Justin, you know this, you feel this too. I have to do that every day, right? There's tons of people who are actively seeking my destruction that I partner with, right? And I have to think about how I can partner with them and not sanction the parts that are evil, right? People are mixed, and it goes all, you know, all the way from, you know, just some random person who I don't know anything about, all the way to people who, you know, I had someone at work was told me that I shouldn't be calling the people who smashed the windows at the store, broke in and tried to would have robbed my safe if there had been any money in it. I can't call those people rioters because that offended them. Right? So I have to work with these people, right? I have to cooperate with these people. And that's fine. That's something I'm okay with doing, right? I can figure out ways to that where our values align, where our interests align, and find win-win situations, right? But when they've, in looking at it in a more positive way, they've decided that people who are not anti-racist are destruction. So therefore, they're going to, you know, treat them like trash, right? So if you don't have this discussion where you say, hey, not put your beliefs aside, but where do we align? That's how these kinds of cooperative groups work, right? I can work with a communist on the music charity that I raise money for, right? Why? Because we both like music and we both like the same kind of music and we can work together on that, right? But I'm not going to work with them and I wouldn't ask them to work with me on some sort of like, you know, political economic freedom advocacy group, right? It wouldn't make any sense. But the other side, the social justice side, their ideology cuts them off from this kind of cooperation, which I think will ultimately has two consequences. One, it leads them to force, right? If you don't want to deal with men with persuasion and cooperation, you have to deal with them with force. We see that in Antifa. That's one consequence. But I think the second consequence, the longer term consequence, is the movement will destroy itself. And we're already seeing this. The movement will constantly be excommunicating its best, quote unquote, its most ardent supporters, and eventually destroy itself. Now, unfortunately, there'll be a lot of that first consequence happening before the second consequence takes effect. I don't know. What do you think about that, Justin?
The force before the excommunication of their most ardent supporters?
Yeah, that this whole idea of these two things happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think the two things are accurate. They're very well taken. I think the force will happen first because of what you talked about before that, where you talked about the position people like you or I are in. Because there's an inequitable, see what I did there, way people are dealing with each other. And what I mean by that is, you and I can work with people we disagree with because, and you can correct me if I'm not speaking for you, but I believe I am, we are genuinely trying when we're making a deal to make it a win-win deal, as you said. When we're interacting with people, we're trying to make it win-win. But those people are not interested in win-win deals. They're interested in either no deal or destructive deals. And what right. I find most frustrating in life is it's usually no deals, where people are just so, I find nowadays people are so convinced of their own superiority. And this is a way that even if they're not social justice, they've taken on, you know, the religious undertones, the narcissistic undertones of it, where they're so convinced of their own superiority that they'd rather, you know, waste my time and waste my resources than have a win-win situation. Because they don't need the help. They don't think the help wouldn't be an advantage to they think the help wouldn't be an advantage to them, or they don't think it would be an advantage to them. So I see that resulting in force. Because for someone like me, I'll just throw in the towel. I'll just be like, fuck it, okay, whatever, I don't care. Because I'm smart enough. I can handle it on my own. I've been doing it my whole life. I've been, you know, on the mid-side my whole life. I've been a loner my whole life. But what happens when the majority of people are put in this position, where they're trying to have win-win positions, and they're coming up against people who either want a no-win situation or they want them to lose.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the only way, if you can't deal with men as traitors, there's only one other option. And we already seen that. I mean, Portland, right?
Hey, William, you know when I talked about that? I talked about that in my episode on Zack Snyder, Ayn Rand, and objectivism and the truth about those three together. I talked about the traitor principle versus force and how that is in his movies. I literally talked about exactly that point you just made.
Yeah.
That's so great. So go listen to that episode. I really nailed that point very well. It's such a good point. You're either a traitor or a warrior. Those are the only two things you are. And you have to decide in life what you want to be. And that's the thing.
Even a warrior can be a traitor, right? But you have to.
Yes, I'm using a facile dichotomy here.
Yeah, yeah.
You can be like, okay, I'm going to be a warrior, like football players are warrior, right? Or like a soldier can be a warrior, right? I mean, you know, you either are a traitor or you decide you want to deal with other people, be a force.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. And I was using warrior to say that. I think Ayn Rand would use the term mystic, right? And she would say either mystic of muscle or mystic of mind.
Yep.
All right. But that's a whole other discussion. You get the point. Do you want to move on to talk about some movies?
I can't wait. Let's do it.
All right. So we're going to talk about an all DC fandom episode of Trailer Takedown in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. If you want to continue the conversation during the week, you can always join us in the Discord channel. I discovered a Midsider is down the street in Disney World this week. So there, I guess you could even potentially meet me if you join the Discord channel and you're in Orlando. So go to themidside.com/podcast or themidside.com, click on any episode link, and you can get a link to our Discord channel. Usually, also, when Trailer Takedown is happening, I post the videos, I embed them on the website, but this week I didn't, because all of the trailers came out the day before the episode, after the outline was done, on DC Fandom. And it wasn't until I had seen a bunch that I was like, you know what, fuck it, let's do this. And I kind of organized it last minute. So this is actually bonus content. You were just going to get the stories this week. So William, let's get into the bonus content. What did I step on, Daniel? Oh, wait, he's not here to respond to that.
All right, let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
First, we're going to talk about what you all want to hear us talk about. The teaser for Zack Snyder's Justice League. You know I'm going to love this. You know I'm going to have positive things to say about it. I think it's going to be more interesting to hear what William says. But I think to me, what was most ironic was interesting. I've already jumped ahead in my analysis. Is he used the song Alleluia, and it's an ironic song. It's supposed to be sort of like a bit cynical towards worship, a bit cynical towards celebration. But this whole trailer was a celebration of his movie, celebration of the movement, the Snyder Cut movement, and a celebration of just heroism in general. And I think seeing this trailer, it gives me a lot of hope, because it shows that Zack Snyder understands what the actual cultural battle is. Not that there was ever a doubt of that, but he sort of doubled down on it. And he's saying, all of you who came out against me, it's because you actually hate the good and you hate heroism. And I understand that now. And this is the trailer for it. So obviously you know that this is a hug for me.
Hug.
William?
Yeah, so I don't know what parts are from, like, I wanted to approach this just watching it as a trailer, right? So I tried to set aside anything I knew about, you know, the Justice League movie, right? And just try to appreciate it that way. Because it's been a while since I've watched Justice League, so I can kind of, you know, just watch it as a trailer. And
I honestly don't remember Justice League. I don't.
Yeah, So I really appreciated the, for me, it was, and I think you said this in your review, it felt like a very well integrated trailer. And what I mean by that is everything that from the way the music and the scenes and the way the acting sort of matched the music, it really drew me in. And I think that's what we want in a trailer. It doesn't really, it doesn't go too deep on what is going to happen, right? Which I guess is okay because, you know, the movie already is out there, right? So people kind of know what happens. Another thing I noticed is, you know, the villain.
It's only a teaser. So it went into the basic conflict. Like this dude comes and he conquers planets and we have to fight him. Yeah. That's all you need. It's a teaser.
Yep. And, I think the villain looks a little better. Than I remember. So, I think it's going to be great. I'm interested to see when they release a full trailer. We are expecting it when, maybe this fall, maybe early next year. There's still no date.
2021 is when it's supposed to come out.
Okay. Yeah.
It's going to be in 4-hour-long episodes, and then there's going to be a supercut of all 4 hours together. I'm hoping that it can come out before next summer, and then we can wait and watch it during my bachelor party and have the Snyder Cut be a big part of my bachelor party.
Oh, that would be great. That would be really great. So, yeah, I don't think we can even deny the fact that I'm going to give this a hug.
Hug.
It's so funny, William, to hear you talk about Steppenwolf, the villain, and looking different. That was a huge thing. Like, he had that design in pre-production, and WB was like, nope, and they redesigned it to the point that there's a Funko of the crappy design.
I didn't know that. See, I told you, I've forgotten everything I knew about Justice League.
There's a Funko of the crappy design from Justice League that was even going to be in the 2:14 cut. So what people don't know is not only is he going back to the 2:14 cut, but he's adding stuff and he's actually improving even more. So if you look at his original trailer, because Snyder had a trailer originally, there's even stuff different from that. So the Snyder Cut movement was so successful that not only are they getting the movie, they're getting an even better version of the movie they would have gotten if he had just released it in theaters to begin with. Because even his version, the 2:14 version, would have been a compromised version to begin with.
Wow.
Second trailer.
The Batman is the latest iteration on the big screen of the titular hero, directed by Matt Reeves and starring Robert Pattinson. Apparently it takes place on Earth 2 where there is no Joker. That is not in the trailer. That is something I read. So let's talk about the trailer specifically. If you think that Christopher Nolan's Batman was dark or Batman versus Superman was dark, you need to watch this trailer. To me, this trailer played like a horror movie. This was like a cross between Saw and The Purge to me, where you had, I'm assuming it's the Riddler leaving notes for the Joker everywhere, being like, do you want to play a game? And then you have Batman just like fucking, you could see him breaking bones and shit. Robert Pattinson, you hear him talk as Batman at one point. He comes in and he like punches the shit out of a guy and then he says, I am vengeance. I think his Batman voice is amazing. I don't know if it's better than Affleck's because I like the idea of the whole voice modulator. I think that makes more sense than like growling, but it blows Christian Bale's out of the water. I was very impressed with that line, but overall, I don't know. Look, I'm going to see this movie because I'm curious as to what it's going to happen. And I'm curious as to the takes on Batman, especially as juxtaposed with Nolan and Snyder. But when I watch this trailer, William, and I'm really interested to hear what you think, when I watch this trailer, I just have a reaction of no, I don't want to see this. I mean, it even looks like Batman's just in like work boots. I don't know. It's so weird. You would think, oh, Snyder fans, dark, blah, blah, blah. But this just doesn't appeal to me. So I'm going to have to, even though I'm going to see it, besides the cultural curiosity, because you guys know I see a lot of things, like I'm going to see New Mutants coming up and review it on the show out of cultural curiosity and out of, you know, providing you content on the show. Beyond that, I wouldn't see this. It's the same thing as Joker, right? I said Joker looked terrible, and I saw it, and it was terrible. I hope this is better than it looks. Tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, so the pessimist in me, which is a very small part, thinks this is, yeah, this is the Joker movie reskinned for Batman, right?
That's how I felt. I was like, I know they say there's no Joker in this universe, but with how young Pattinson is and how old Phoenix is, and the way they had that scene where there was the young Bruce Wayne in the Joker movie, it really felt like they were setting up this Batman to fight that Joker, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But like you, I can see this going in a positive direction, right? Like there is potential here just based on the trailer, and I have to judge it based on the trailer. There's a story that could be told, and it feels like this could be the story they're trying to tell of a harsher Batman coming to justice, right? Like Batman being vengeance versus justice, right? This is a story that has been explored in the comics in different ways, right?
I think that's what they're going for.
Yeah, if that's what they're going for, I'm willing to watch that. Does that make sense? Like if we're in Earth 2 and it's a darker time and he comes to, you know, realize, you know, comes to appreciate and then implement justice, right? Then that would be an interesting movie. So I'm sitting on the fence with you, but I'm sitting on the other side. I'm sitting on the hug side.
Hug?
Yeah, well, I can see it go either way. So it's just I was just talking about like my initial emotional reaction, you know? I was like, where's Jigsaw? Where's Tobin Bell?
Final trailer.
Wonder Woman 1984 is the sequel to the huge smash hit Wonder Woman starring Gal Gadot. Takes place during the 80s, so we see how they're jumping forward in time here because the last one took place during World War I. Steve Trevor is back. I don't know, William, did I miss in the trailer? Did they explain in the trailer how he comes back?
I didn't understand it.
Yeah, okay. I didn't understand that point either. But there is a line in this trailer that blows me away that this is in the trailer that single-handedly makes me want to see this movie. Now, we have to take the context into account here. This movie is set in the 80s. This line feels like it would be an 80s movie, but the fact that they're releasing this in the year 2020 and they're not trying to undo the 80s like even some people in the 80s were trying to do, you know, we talk about John Hughes with trying to tear down the alpha and prop up the beta, and we saw that in a lot of movies, you know, like Revenge of the Nerds. Oh, the alphas are evil and corrupt. That's a lot of the seeding culturally of the social justice movement. So there is a line in this trailer. Kristen Wiig's villain says this while fighting Diana Prince, and I was blown away. She says, "People like you have always had everything. Now it's my turn." That's the villain saying that. You would think nowadays the good guy would be... William, out of context, if I gave you that line, wouldn't that sound like a hero saying that in the year 2020?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. So it seems like Patty Jenkins will continue her reverence for Wonder Woman and her reverence for the heroic and will actually pinpoint what the non-heroic and villainous is. So I'm excited for this movie. I want to see it. I have high hopes for this movie. Because that line, I would think that line was in a Snyder movie. That's how good that line is. Hug.
Hug.
William?
All right, yeah. I agree with everything you've said in your part. I love the aesthetic, right? They've done the attention to detail in the 80s aesthetic is great. Gal Gadot's, like, facial expressions, her body movements, everything is just so spot on, right? And it's a pleasure to watch. So I can't wait to see this movie. I'm very excited about it. I'm gonna give my hug, but then I have one other thing to talk about this movie because I want your thoughts on it.
Hug.
So the director, I forgot her name, the director of this movie, you know, she took on the Wonder Woman, and this was when Snyder was kind of being sidelined at Warner Brothers, and you know, there was this idea that she would have a trilogy, but it not really connected necessarily to the to the you know, Snyder's vision of the DCEU. So there's a lot of talk now, well, whether there will be a third movie. And so I don't know, Justin, if you've been covering this sort of inside baseball stuff, but, you know, do you think that, first, do you think that thematically that her vision and Snyder's vision can be integrated? And then second, how do you, you know, if you do think it, how do you bring these sort of things together, right, in a way that respects each creator's independence? In other words, how do you not turn it into a mishmash of like the MCU, right? Like how do you give these directors the independence they need to tell a good story and still bring them together in the sort of saga-like fashion that you see in the MCU? Or can it be done?
So there's a couple answers to your question. Narratively, ship's already sailed. And what I mean by that is this Wonder Woman existing in the 80s already contradicts Batman versus Superman. It contradicts Justice League, where, you know, the Age of Hero, they said the Age of Heroes will never come again. It has to. Well, if she's been around in the 80s, unless the Men in Black cross over and wipe everyone's memories, Clark's not the first Superman. It's not the first superhero when he becomes Superman and Man of Steel. So Wonder Woman is already narratively different, just mechanically. That said, I think thematically it can line up. I don't see anything in the first Wonder Woman besides the, you know, the ill-defined love, right? They never really define love at the end. And they kind of do a shittier version of the self-sacrifice. They don't really explain it. They kind of seem more like Steve Trevor is just doing it more altruistically than Superman is sacrificing for what he loves. I think it'll be more akin that way thematically. But that goes ultimately to what DC is doing as a marketing technique, which is so fucking stupid, but people are buying it hook, line, and sinker. Have you heard of this concept of the multiverse?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty common in the comic books.
Well, right, but that's what they're doing. They're saying, well, we're just going to have the DC multiverse now, so we can have multiple versions of all these characters, and they're all canon. Why do you need, as a viewer, as an audience member, someone to call it a multiverse to accept it as canon? I don't care what the fuck you call it. If you just say Zack Snyder's directing a Batman movie, I don't care how it fits in with anything else. Now, when Snyder does his movies, they should be consistent with each other, if that's what he wants. But why do I care that Matt Reeves' movie isn't going to be consistent with Zack Snyder's movie? Well, then, I'm going to take that a step further. Even though Patty Jenkins has the same actress playing Wonder Woman, and she has all of the same sort of aesthetic with costume and everything, why do I care if narratively it doesn't fit with Zack Snyder's story? Can't those two stories exist and I can enjoy both?
Yeah, I think I understand where you're going. I think the way I would phrase it for myself is I want the story first. What I mean by that is, and that's something that MCU did not provide me, right, was the story first. And I think it's a great achievement when you're telling multiple stories and they integrate with your theme, right? And the universe sort of integrates, right? Like that, I think that's a great achievement. But
I think Marvel did achieve something. I don't think you can disagree that what makes Marvel so insidious with what they did to the Iron Man is they achieved something that was anti-achievement. And that's right. So fucking terrifying. That's why I don't support Marvel. You can say, hey, you can marvel at what they did and say that what they used it for nefarious purposes. DC is not trying to accomplish the same thing. DC is just going to hit us with a bunch of fucking movies. I mean, think of it this way. Another question I could ask you, it's akin to the same thing. You're asking how Wonder Woman 84 is going to fit with Zack Snyder's movies? Well, how is James Gunn's The Suicide Squad, which has Margot Robbie playing Harley Quinn, going to fit with Birds of Prey, which just came out?
Yeah. Yeah,
and I don't think it's probably going to be the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's okay. So one final parting thought before we end the show. Did not make the cut because we had this episode's already going on too long. If you guys are interested, there's a great trailer for the video game Justice League, right? Or no? Yeah, Suicide Squad.
It's called Suicide Squad: Kill the Justice League.
Yeah, thank you. And
I'm not even a comics guy, and I know all of this shit because of Zack Snyder. It's ridiculous.
It's a great cinematic. If you're interested, you should watch it. It's got a nice little surprise at the end.
Holy shit, dude. The graphics. I saw a still, and I thought it was a fucking movie.
I thought it was great. The voice acting was great. And maybe we'll get around to reviewing it if we see another trailer of it. But I thought just because we're all DC, I had to mention it.
All right, William, what did you learn this trip?
That I learned that it's not enough to be anti-racist. I have to refuse to hold my black friend's baby. Justin, what did you learn this week?
That Zack Snyder's destroyed me by making me know way more about comics than I ever intended to in my entire life. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelzneski reminding you that when things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a wonderful DC Universe Day. So what is our diversity and inclusion policy here at the Midside? Have we published our statement yet? I think you should probably write one and put it on the website. We could probably come up with some funny farcical diversity and inclusion statement.
Oh, if you want to do it farcical, yeah. Otherwise, our diversity policy is fuck you.
Well, that could be the beginning, right? Summary, TLDR, fuck you. And then have the... or have it at the end.
In summary, fuck you.